During this podcast, you'll hear the keynote address to the 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference delivered by Haley Barbour, former governor of Mississippi and former chairman of the Republican National Committee. First, there's an introduction by the president of the Migration Policy Institute, Dimitrios Papadimitriou. Here's Dr. Papadimitriou.
Good morning, everyone. We have a walk-in. So, I'm not going to push it. We all know why we're here. Immigration is again, and has been for the past year, so in the forefront of the political and the policy process. We're going to try to sort of take the temperature of the issue, try to figure out where we are, take some guesses about where we might be going, and all the smart people who will actually be doing all of that will come certainly after me. But before I introduce our keynote, Governor Barbour, I wanted to say something that may be very obvious to everyone, but nonetheless I felt that I should punctuate it. It is now almost trite to simply say that immigration defines who we are as a nation. We all understand this. Whatever wars there may have been in the past, whatever disagreements, whatever anything, are past us. It does not mean that they have ended, but we've had all of these arguments. They may be simmering, but we've had them. But what is more important for us to constantly be keeping in the front of our mind is that immigration defines who we are as a nation as we move forward. It defines the future of this country. And it does so for a very simple reason that we also all understand. I'm sorry for stating the obvious, but, you know, I think at my age, that's what I typically do. It basically changes the society's DNA. And I know that some of you are thinking, DNA, well, you know, is he talking about phenotype? Is he talking about the ethnic composition of the country? What is he talking about? And of course, I'm talking about those things too. But I'm talking about things that go well beyond that. Immigration basically changes how society is organized. It changes how political power is distributed. And it changes the still makeup of the country, which is at the core of competitiveness. If we can't understand that decisions that we make today will affect who we will be as a nation 10 and 20 and 30 years from now, and how all of these different things will change, then we almost shouldn't be in the immigration business. So as we're trying to figure out what to do about the 11 point whatever million people, what to do about having employers play by the rules in terms of employing only people who are work authorized, as we try to figure out, you know, what to do with families, what to do with the backlogs, all of these things that you will all be talking about for the rest of the day, let's keep in mind that we're talking about who we are and who we'll be as a country. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce Governor Haley Barbour. I know that he needs no introduction. He has a distinguished career going back to the Reagan years as the political director of the Reagan White House, being the chairman of the Republican National Committee, particularly in the critical years from 1993 to 1997, which also included the turning over of the House and the Senate in the 1994 election, which he managed. He has been governor of Mississippi for 8 years, and he has been just about everything else that you can imagine as a senior, thoughtful Republican leader has been. But back in 1987, he also started his own consulting firm, of which, of course, he's founder and president. And he has been one of the sane, thoughtful voices on immigration, not just for the Republicans, but also for the country more generally. Before I ask Governor Barbour to come out, I also want to say, in a sense, echo what Andy did. This is a partnership. Four institutions are involved. He mentioned the institutions. I would like to thank their directors and their staffs for continuing to put an awful lot of effort in order to make these events a success. This is the 10th year that we're holding this event. We're grateful, of course, you know, for Georgetown Law School not only participating and co-developing this conference, but also providing the space. We're grateful to the rest of the partners. Thank you. Now, it is my pleasure to welcome and present to you Governor Barbour.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I'm honored to be the keynote speaker, if that's the... This thing does have a mind of its own, doesn't it, Dimitri? I guess it's where if the speaker's doing badly, you can hide behind it while you're taking it over to the door. But at any rate, I'm delighted to have the high title of the keynote speaker for the 10th Annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference. And you have to be asking yourself, why would they ask a former governor of Mississippi to do this? And I want to just start off saying to you how I got interested in immigration and why. That led me ultimately to be the co-chairman of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Immigration Task Force. I was governor of Mississippi when Katrina hit, worst natural disaster in American history. On the Mississippi Gulf Coast, 64,000 units of housing in a few hours were made uninhabitable. That's about half of the total housing stock in the three counties. Another 40,000 units of housing not on the coast were made totally uninhabitable. We had 231 fatalities, 30% of whom were not on the coast. It wasn't just a coastal calamity for us. We had hurricane force winds 240 miles inland, and the storm surge on the Mississippi Gulf Coast reached 38 feet, the highest in ever recorded in the history of meteorology, according to the National Weather Service. It was utter obliteration. I flew over the coast Tuesday morning after the storm on Monday, and it looked like the hand of God had just wiped away areas of the coast, some places for blocks, some places for miles. Very shortly thereafter, dawned on me. If you lived on the coast and your house got blown away, and you didn't have anything left but a slab, the guy that you would have normally called to come build you a new house, his house blew away or got washed away. And there was no labor to do the work. Yet, over a pretty short period of time, we had an enormous influx of Spanish-speaking labor. I have no doubt that some of them weren't in the United States legally. They numbered in the thousands, not the hundreds. And they worked. They lived in dreadful conditions. But they worked from before dawn till after dark to try to help our people get back into some place that they could live. Within a year, the population of the Mississippi Gulf Coast was 92% of what it had been before the storm, which is the key to rebuilding, to get people to come home to their communities. And I can just tell you, would not have happened without this Spanish-speaking labor. Just absolutely would not have happened. That made me very interested in immigration because, well, for obvious reasons. We need immigration reform in America because it's America's best interest that will be served by immigration reform. I'm a born-again Christian, and my view of trying to help people is an important thing in my life. But government decisions ought to be made about what's best for America. And immigration reform is best for America because we are in a global battle for capital and labor. And make no mistake about it, we need the labor. I tell a little story that is not apocryphal, literally true. In Mississippi, we have a very good correction system. It has been judged the top in the United States in the last 5 years. And one of the things we try to do is get the inmates to work. I'm very clear that if they do skills training and work, then they got a whole lot better chance of going out and never coming back. Well, one of our small prisons is in a county that's where there's a big chicken industry. You may not, should no reason for you to realize it, but the biggest agricultural product in Mississippi is not cotton. The biggest agricultural product is broilers, chickens, poultry. We do about $5.5 billion of processed chicken in Mississippi every year. And if you go in a chicken processing plant in Mississippi, not anybody on the floor speaks English. The music is turned on to Latin music. It isn't turned on to pop or rock or hip hop or anything like that. It's not a word I could understand. So we have a program to allow inmates to go into the local industries and work. They get paid exactly what the regular workers get paid. The state takes back from their pay the cost of incarceration and then gives them the balance in an account that they get when they get out. It's very, very popular. Except at Walnut Grove, which is the prison and the chicken processor, we've never had an inmate make it a week. They would rather be in prison than have to work in a chicken processing plant. The people that tell you, well, they're taking jobs away from Americans. Many of the people here illegally are taking jobs Americans won't do. And I'm here to tell you, being in prison, no fun. When you'd rather be in prison, and I mean physically in prison, than have a job where you can make between $9 and $10 an hour. Most of the guys are back in 2 days. We are in a global battle for capital and labor, and it is wrong to think that what we need is just H-1B, STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math people. We have a huge need for essential, low-skilled, often temporary labor, and we've got people that want to come do the work. In fact, there are 11 million people or so here who have come here illegally, or the PC way of saying that, undocumented. I should pause at this point to make the point. Even though I am the co-chairman of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Immigration Task Force with Governor Ed Rendell of Pennsylvania, Secretary Henry Cisneros, former Secretary of HUD, who's from Texas, and former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice of California. We still like to claim she's from Alabama, where she grew up. I notice she's done better losing her accent than I. But at any rate, I do want you to know that the views I'm going to give here are mine, not the Bipartisan Policy Center. I am very pleased to tell you that on so many issues, we've reached agreement. And without any rancor or discord, but I don't want anybody saying, well, Haley said this, and so that's the BPC position, because as encouraging as it is and how much together, some things we haven't got to yet. But let's talk about why it is important to our country. It's important to our country because of economic growth. We're sitting here with very tepid economic growth, about 2%. I remember very well the last deep recession ended in 1982. In the first 3 years after that recession ended, economic growth the first year was 4.5%. The second year was 7.3%. The third year is 4.1%. We haven't had a year since this recession ended that was half that. It's been in the high ones and the low twos. We need more economic growth, a bigger, younger workforce will do that, will help us do that. I want to call your attention to the Bipartisan Policy Center's economic study on immigration reform. A couple of things that I think are that I want you to take away. Let me say you can get this off the Bipartisan Policy Center's website, bipartisanpolicy.org/immigration. Pretty good for a low-tech kind of guy. Almost the whole Western world is aging. Population counteracts, balances out aging. A younger work population is important. 94% in the study, which was done with one of the major macroeconomic advisory companies in the country, 94% of the people who come here in the next 20 years, if we were to pass the Senate bill, and let me just emphasize, I'm not here to promote the Senate bill. I'm here to promote immigration reform, and I think the Senate bill can be improved on. But that 94% of those people would be working age, under 65, that economic growth would increase by 2.8% over 10 years and 4.8% over 20 years with the right kind of immigration reform. I should add, this is very consistent with what the Congressional Budget Office found. Federal revenues will go up, not down. The deficit will go down, not up, because of this. The alternative is what we got now. And what we got now is terrible. It doesn't work for anybody. It doesn't work for employers, employees, undocumented, or taxpayers. That doesn't mean just any immigration reform's great. It needs to be good immigration reform. I was in the White House in 1986. When we did immigration reform, when we did Simpson-Mazzoli, a lot of things about it weren't very well thought out. And I think that House, the idea that the House is going to have their own process and they're going to go through it piece by piece has a lot to recommend it. I don't see there's anything wrong with that at all. That's the way the process is supposed to work. Rather than have one great big bill, what we have historically done in my 40 years in and around government, committees in both houses consider things. They take it to the floor. The floor changes what the committee does and so on, rather than the process the Senate used, which is not to say that was bad, but it is certainly not inherently superior to what the House is going to do. I think we have to deduce from this study and from every study that economically America is served by good immigration reform. I have to say that I am struck by the people who seem to think that we're going to arrest, incarcerate, or deport 11 million people. There's a 100% chance that's not going to happen. I mean, we just don't have the capacity to do that. And I can't think of anything goofier than to look at 4-5 million people who came here illegally, who are working, often at the same job for years or even decades. Why in God's name would we send them home and then have to try to find 4-5 million people to replace them with? Where are they going to come from? Nobody in his right mind thinks we're going to deport 11 million people. So what are we going to do? How do we deal with that? Well, I think the first thing the American people want is to believe that this time when we talk about border security, that we mean it. I remember very well, Alan Simpson, where he's standing here, the sponsor will be able to tell you, what was the first promise we made the American people? We're going to control the border. Never did. Never did, still haven't. You know, a good recession kind of slows down illegal immigration. And that's the main reason that illegal immigration is slowing down, because we've had a terrible recession and we have such a low percentage of Americans working today. About 58% of adult Americans are employed, 58.5, which means that fewer than 50% of Americans have a full-time job. That's what slowed down illegal immigration, a bad economy. But what should we do? We should tell the American people, A, this is in the best interest of our country. We need more workers. We need them in technology and H-1B. We need them in agriculture. We need them in other temporary guest worker, whatever you say, essential low-skill labor. We need all that, and we shouldn't act like it's just H-1Bs we're going to solve the problem. You know, I am an advocate of if a person graduates from Mississippi State University with a Ph.D. in engineering, we ought to staple a green card to his diploma. So instead of going home to Mumbai and starting a business that employs 800 people, he'll go to Memphis and start a business that employs 800 people, which is what he would like to do if we'd let him. So this is good for employment of native, well, I don't mean Native Americans like American Indians, but of American citizens who have been lifelong citizens. But we have to understand when we tell the American people we're going to secure the border, that's a little bit misleading. Because about 40% of the people in the United States illegally entered legally. About 40% of the people who entered or here illegally entered legally. They had a valid visa. Just when their visa expired, they didn't go home. Now, we're talking about 4.5 million people here. Now, we're not talking about some little small subset. This is a very large subset. So I hope in the next couple of minutes, as I talk about border security, that your mind will hear also controlling the overstaying by people who entered legally on visas, because that is absolutely essential for border security. But the American people were told one time, we're going to secure the border. And we didn't. And let me say, I don't say that in a partisan way. The first 6 years after immigration reform in 86, we had Republican presidents. I worked for one of them. This is no administration of either party has ever made much effort here. And we need to. But the American people cannot be expected to say, oh, okay, we'll take your word for it. They took Washington's word for it once, and they didn't get anything. So the Senate solution to that was throw a bunch of money at it, have this big border surge. I would suggest the more appropriate way to convince the American people we're actually going to secure the border is to do it. Under the Senate bill, if you take it, and again, I'm not here to advocate the Senate bill, but under the Senate bill, essentially, legalization happens on the front end. People who are here illegally and haven't committed a crime and have a good record and have a job, and quite a little list of things, they become documented legal aliens. It's 10 years before they can get a green card under the Senate bill. It's 13 years before citizenship. Well, I would suggest to you, if we don't secure the border in the first 10 years, we're probably not going to secure it. That may come as a radical thought to you, but I believe that we should have green cards or we should at least consider having green cards and citizenship be triggered only after certain metrics have actually been met for border control, including visas. I think they will be met. I don't think it'll be close. I think it'll be met in years 4, 5, 6, 7, something like that. But to say, take our word for it, is asking a whole lot of the American people after what they have been through once. A lot of Americans, not just Republicans, think, take our word for it, it'll never happen, and we'll have another 20 million illegal immigrants here in 10 more years. So one thing I think that should be considered by the House is, should there be metrics that have to be met before certain things happen? Pretty simple question comes from that. Well, golly, the people here would then be legalized immigrants, but not green card holders or citizens. It wouldn't be their fault if the border security wasn't actually done. Should we punish them? And the answer is, of course, it's not their fault. However, it's not the taxpayer's fault either. It's not the general public's fault either. If we're going to punish somebody, punish the politicians, don't get it done. But my own view is it would get done. People would not tolerate not meeting the standards that we set. I am afraid you may not be able to get as good a bill passed as you should get if you don't do it that way. So there is an idea that maybe is not on the on everybody's list, but I think would help pass the bill and get the American people to accept it. The second thing is we need more of the people who come to the United States on green cards and legally to work. There are studies that show that fewer than 20% of the people who come here on a green card come here to work. Obviously, the higher percentage that come to work, the better it is for the Treasury, the less likely it is that it makes deficits larger rather than smaller, and the better it is for the economy. If we had 70% who worked rather than 17% who worked, how much better would that be for the American economy? It would be a whole lot better, and it would be a whole lot better deal for the taxpayers. These are some of the things that are still going to be kicking around in front of us. How do we convince the American people that border security is on the up and up? How are we going to make sure that this isn't a huge cost to future generations? And I think I've told you very reasonable answers to both. I, for one, am very comfortable with a path to citizenship if the requirements for that are rigorous enough. I think the Senate bill, very rigorous. However, I think border security and stopping overstaying of visas is something that will be used by opponents who say, we don't want to reward people for breaking the law. So how do we make sure that doesn't ever happen again? It isn't by having politicians promise you it won't happen again. Been down that road, and that dog won't hunt. Let me close by saying this. I think reform is very doable. I think there's a real possibility the House will take it up this year. If not, I think that it'll be taken up next year. Ought to be done. It's in the best interest of the country. And if we don't do it, the situation gets worse and worse and worse. Even for the people who are the least sold on what's right, they understand what's wrong. What would be wrong would be to do nothing and keep what we've got, because what we've got is an abject failure, and it's not going to get better. Let me just say, I hope that you won't give up on this, because there's been a time period between the Senate and the House. I hope you won't be discouraged or critical of the idea that the House is using a different process. That's not unusual at all. Actually, the House process is more typical of how Americans, Congress passes legislation than the Senate process. And finally, I hope you'll push hard among your constituents, groups, among your friends, among your neighbors, for why this is in America's best interest. Because it clearly is in America's best interest, and we need it to be. With that, I think I'll stop. Thank you all for letting me.
Governor,
I think I'm going to take some questions, Dimitri.
Right, let me tell you that some of the best people I know are decided in law text, so no reason for you to be worried about that. But while people, you know, sort of think about their questions, we have about 10 minutes or so, and the governor will be taking them directly. I want to ask you perhaps the first question, writing in Politico, of course, back on August 15, you and your three co-chairs made a short, direct, declarative statement. It reads, "But where some people may see conflict, we see real progress." Now, 2.5 months later, do you still see real progress?
Well, I really do. First of all, despite President Obama's periodically doing things by executive order, immigration reform got to be done by Congress. And it is not offensive to me one iota that since they haven't passed a budget in 4 years, and since the government shuts down periodically when there is an appropriation, when appropriation bills aren't passed or a continuing resolution for funding is not passed, that should take first priority. I mean, it doesn't bother me a bit. What bothers me a bit is Congress gives so little time to taxes and spending rather than they push some other things off so they can deal with it. Now, do I wish they'd have dealt with it more smartly? Well, that's a different question. But does it discourage me? And a lot of times a little cooling saucer for the hot coffee to be poured into is not a bad deal for people to kind of calm down and get their acts together. But I don't want to lead you to believe this. I am not saying that I'm confident that the House will move this year. Mm-hmm. May move next year. If they don't, clearly in 2015.
Thank you. The floor is open and we have microphones. Please raise your hand and one of the microphones will be brought to you. I see. Please, up sure. There.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the governor will take his own questions. Sorry.
Hi, Governor Gene Butterfield with the Raven Group and the Alliance for Citizenship. Thank you so much for your remarks and for the great work of the Policy Center. What would you advise us who represent a whole variety of constituencies to do to help increase the prospects that the House will act? We know there's been several bills passed through the committee by regular order. We know the leadership has things they could draw on, but what's it going to take?
Well, as I say, the first thing I think, they had previously set a window for early October to deal with this, and then, of course, that was pushed back because of the government shutdown and the debt ceiling expiration. I think what you ought to be doing is lobbying your congressmen or in the constituents groups, and I think this message here is a pretty simple message. This should be done because it's in America's interest. This shouldn't be done over politics. And as a Republican who, this issue cut very badly for Republicans last time, that's still no – politics isn't the reason to do this. The reason to do this is good policy for America. If we're going to have a stronger economy, a more prosperous nation, if our children and grandchildren are going to have the kind of future – that we want them to have a future that is as promising as we have had, this is absolutely in the best interest of doing that. And this study confirms that. The Congressional Budget Office confirms that. But do it in regular order, but do it. Don't serve the cause if you say you ought to do this because it's politically good or bad. And I will take a second to tell you why. 435 in the House, about 350 of them are immune to defeat in the general election. We got about 350 congressional districts that if you win your primary, you're going to be reelected. So you got about 150 House Democrats whose political plan has never let anybody get to the left of me. And you got about 200 House Republicans whose political plan is don't let anybody get to the right of me. Because if I win the primary, I am golden for two more years. So the politics of this is, for a lot of Republicans, they have some people who are opposed to rewarding people for breaking the law. And they have to be shown by the Farm Bureau, by the business community, by depends on where you are, of course, by the high tech communities of California and Texas and other states, that it is in their best interest and they can win the primary supporting this, and the facts are on our side, if we can make it about the facts. And so helping make it about the facts, very important. Yes, sir.
Governor, you were talking about your experience with immigrants after Katrina, but did you have any different perception before? Maybe you appreciated more after the work in Katrina? And do you think the position of many members in your party is due to pressure of their constituents, or is it just maybe also lack of knowledge about it?
Well, I mean, look, there is a group, Republicans and labor union Democrats. Let's don't try to cover that over. Labor union Democrats who have two arguments. Don't reward people for breaking the law. They came here illegally, which reminds me, my great-grandfather was an Irish immigrant. And I can tell you, during Prohibition, they served whiskey and drank it. They didn't make it. They didn't sell it. But they broke the law. By God's grace, nobody ever said they ought to send my family back to Ireland because we broke the law. Because they'd have sent a hell of a lot of Americans back somewhere during Prohibition for breaking the law. Well, if I lived in Mexico and watched the lack of effort of the United States to enforce border control, to me that would make it like Prohibition. Unserious, you know, in enforcement. So I don't buy that these people, we essentially invited these people to come by having jobs that we couldn't fill. But the other thing about this is the idea that they're taking jobs away from Americans. But just simply, in the vast majority of cases, that's just not the truth. And so the Democrats that believe that and try to use it to incite the Republicans, and the Republicans who believe that, just you get familiar with the real facts. And this study, by the way, bears that out. That if we send home the illegals that are here today, the GDP would decline by 5.7% over 20 years compared to what it would have been. If we pass good immigration reform, it would go up 4.8%. So you're talking about a 10% difference in the growth of our economy because of this one policy issue. So to me, good policy, as my old boss Ronald Reagan used to say, good policy at the end of the day is good politics. And that's what we need to be for, good policy. Father?
Father, if we don't have the charities, Raleigh, North Carolina.
Of course, in order to get anything done, you have to bring it up to a vote in the House. Do you still have any friends in the Mississippi delegation who will vote for anything, for immigration reform?
You know, Father, it's one thing you learn after you've been party chairman and governor, it's not my job to speak for others who are going to vote, but the reported antipathy of Republicans to immigration reform is grossly overstated. Let me say that. The other thing, though, is what does the bill end up looking like? A good bill, rigorous requirements, serious, enforceable border security and visa control. That most of the people come here to work. Those are things that I think make this very attractive for Republicans. Ma'am?
Hi, Lauren Membrano from the Government Accountability Office. My question is, apart from the overstay issue that you were mentioning, what are some metrics as far as the border patrol apprehension piece of it that you think would be calling the border secure? You know, what would that be defined as?
Let me just confess on the front end that I'm not a very good person to ask that. But as you know, in the Senate bill, they set standards. They just didn't say if we don't meet the standards that it has consequences. The standards were 95%, 90% in successful enforcement, and that the illegal population does not go up more than X over a period of time. To me, that's not there's not a magic percentage, but to me what's important is enforcement has to actually happen to trigger the next step. I just think the American, if you did that, I think you wipe away a huge amount of the opposition among the American people, whose opposition is, you know, fool me once, shame on me. Fool me twice, shame on you. I mean, that's vice versa, isn't it? Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me. But they're, but those are people who say, I'm not going to fall for this again. And can you blame them? Thank you all very much.
Please have a hand for our speaker.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.